Chapter 25. Although we had divided our days into two-hour watches, I was up and vigilant myself most of the time until my eyes began to fail. Now, because of that and my general physical condition, I was forced to let the man on watch take full responsibility for the boat while I conserved my dwindling energy for my own two-hour shift. Thus I lay on the forward thwart this 34th morning, turning uneasily under the sun so that my body would burn evenly and I would not suffer unnecessarily from overexposure of any one area more than another. Jean was on watch. Tony was lying in the bottom trying to shade his face. His delirium when he heard the music seemed to have passed. It was about 10 o'clock. The sky was hot and clear as a blue flame. The wind was steady and the boat was rising and falling slowly on long, gentle swells. The sun was just now approaching the fullness of its anger. We topped a wave, and in that brief instant, while we seemed to hang suspended before the long downward slide began, Jean spoke for the first time since taking the watch. "Chief," he said, "I see a beautiful field of corn." I didn't even look up. I thought sadly that the boy's mind had finally gone, and I wished he had taken my advice to cover his head when we first went into the raft. Without moving, I cast my eyes about the sea, but we were in the trough, and I saw only the rumpled carpet of waves. It was possible, I said to myself, that Jean was seeing a mirage. The sun does play tricks on you sometimes. At any rate, I was not surprised that Jean was affected. There was nothing I could do for him, so I paid no more attention. After a few minutes, when we had risen to the next crest, he spoke again insistently. "Sure enough, Chief, I see something green in the distance." With this statement, so rationally put in his Missouri drawl, it dawned upon me suddenly that perhaps he did see something. I looked hard, but could still see nothing in the tumbling sea. Tony was looking too, but he had not spoken. I tried to stand up and found I couldn't, balanced on my cramped and crooked legs. I asked the boys to hold me upright. We stood, the three of us, in the center of the boat, the boys each with one hand against the side and an arm around my waist, holding me erect with their shoulders while I steadied myself with arms around their necks. We came to the summit of the next large swell. Sure enough, in the distance, I could see something green. As Jean had said, it was beautiful. I instantly recognized it as an island, one of the low, verdant atolls of the far South Sea. I let out a hoarse whoop and turned to Jean, tightening my arm about his neck. "Boy," I said exultantly, "you have won yourself a dinner." Jean took a deep breath and let it go out noisily, trying to repress his joy. "Well," he said, "thank God, and it's about time." We were still far off. The island appeared as a low shelf of green, coconut trees, I guessed, and I was right. Chartless, we had no idea what the island was, whether it was inhabited or whether it was in friend or enemy's hands. The wind had risen strongly, making long and prominent streaks on the water, which gave me an excellent gauge of the exact wind direction. I took a bearing on the island, compared it with the wind direction, and found that our course of drift was carrying us about 10 degrees to the right of the island. We realized, of course, that this was our God-given chance for refuge, so, weak as we were, we saw nothing for it but to row. I took the port side of the raft, using our one remaining shoe paddle. Jean and Tony paddled together on the starboard side, using their hands only. We turned to with a will, rowing across the wind to make up for the distance by which the wind would cause us to miss the island if we simply drifted. In this manner we were able to make about 1 knot across the wind, while we were being driven about 5 knots downwind. It was fortunate indeed that we were able to see the island from such a distance. If we had been much closer when we began to row, the wind would have taken us past it, because we would not have been able, by our feeble paddling, to compensate sufficiently for the drift. We rowed all day, exactly across wind at 90 degrees to our sailing direction. I kept watching the island at intervals. We found it better to row facing the stern of the raft, pushing the water behind the boat with a forward sweep of our arms, so I had to stop rowing occasionally and turn to keep my bearing. At first we thought there was only one island, but as we approached we saw that there were two, with a wide gap of water between. It was easy to make a choice. We took the nearer island. By 1 o'clock our progress was visible. The waves were longer and crested in knife-like ridges that curled and broke in a thunderous gush of white foam. There was danger of our tipping over any time one of these breakers got behind us, but while they were in front, the spray blowing backward enabled me to judge the wind exactly. Suddenly, Tony let out a screech. His hand flew out of the water and over his head as if jerked by a string. He half turned, holding the hand tenderly. "Chief, a shark hit my hand," he yelled, his voice shaking slightly. Gene and I hardly hesitated in our rowing. "Did it bite you?" I asked. "No," he said, looking and testing his fingers. "Then to hell with it," I said. "Let's go on rowing." Without another second's hesitation, he jabbed his hand back into the water, deep, and we went on rowing. As we came up on the island, I thought it couldn't possibly be anything but a desert atoll, although it was a lovely green and apparently stuck up pretty well out of the water. When we came within 6 or 8 miles, I saw what I thought was a ledge of rocks above the white beach. I figured then it must be a volcanic island, and we might find shelter in a cavern. This would also mean that the island was marked on the map, and might be visited, by our own or friendly forces, I hoped. There was still the uncertainty that this might be in the Japanese mandate, and if that was so, I could see our doom. However, as long as we were determined to get there, I preferred to think that it was uninhabited. The closer we approached, the better the island looked to me. I could see 2 or 3 especially tall trees that towered above the others. We wondered if they might be coconut trees, but that seemed too much to hope. Until I was close enough to identify them honestly as palms, I didn't dare believe they were. I was sure at any rate that there would be lots of birds on the island, which meant eggs and possibly young birds that we could capture. I thought, too, that there might be mussels and possibly fish in abundance that we would rig spears to catch. Aldrich's eyes were still in good condition. As we came in closer, perhaps within 3 miles of the curving beach, he turned and took a long look. We had seen by this time that the island was not so high as we had thought at first. "Chief," Gene said, "those aren't rocks on the beach. They're shacks." I looked again, and again I decided they were rocks. "Wishful thinking, Gene," I said. "If they were shacks, it would mean that the island is inhabited. They still look like rocks to me." Tony had his revenge. "Hell with the rocks," he said. "Row!" The waves were very high, and we could see the island only when we came to a crest. When we dipped to the valley of the waves, the island sank from sight. The buoyant raft rode the roughening sea so easily that it appeared as if the island and not we were rising and falling steeply in an even rhythm, while the raft lay perfectly still. When we were about 1 mile from the island, I saw from the wind streaks and blowing foam that we were directly upwind, and that the stiff breeze would land us at the center of the beach without assistance. "Okay, boys," I said, "we can knock off the rowing." We stopped and turned about to watch our progress. We were completely exhausted, I now know. We'd been rowing all day on willpower alone, but we were so intent on reaching this island that we didn't realize our terrible weakness and rose above it. "Well," Gene said joyfully, "are they shacks or rocks?" He was right. They were shacks. From now on, it was just a matter of drifting in the wind. I kept a close eye on the bearings by the wind streaks to be sure that we hit the beach. We became conscious of a steady, sullen thunder that seemed to grow in volume. I realized after a moment that it was surf breaking over a barrier reef, and I feared we were in for a little trouble. As we drifted closer, I was able to see, and immediately gave the order to square away for a possible tip-over. I had seen natives bring outrigger canoes over heavy surf in Hawaii, but those breakers were not nearly so murderous as these appeared. The nearer we approached the reef, the larger the breakers looked. I soon saw that our eyes were not deceiving us. These waves were building up characteristically in rows, one behind the other, each coming to its turn as leader of the irresistible flow to shore. The leading wave gained swiftly in height and speed as the wall of coral dammed the powerful tide that pushed against it, and the rushing tons of water found their only outlet upward. When the wave reached the reef, it was about 30 feet high. The crest began to curl dangerously, seemed to hesitate the merest fraction of a second, then fell forward over the natural dam. There was a roar like a cannon shot as the mass of water smashed, and a great burst of foam spewed forward in a straight line of boiling white which diminished in size, but held its form until it washed high on the beach far ahead. These rows of waves were building behind us now. Our only hope was to paddle over the reef ahead of the breaker, that is, in the interval between two waves. We were fortunate enough to pass over the reef at the one brief instant when the surf was not breaking. We could have been dashed against the rocky bottom, or the ledge itself, if we had been caught in that wild churning of forces when the breaker crashes from its great height. As it was, we did not come out unscathed. The breaker caught the raft behind. The heavy blow of the rushing foam against the stern sped us up the sloping rear of the smaller, shoreward-speeding wave ahead. Instead of sliding down its front, we shot straight out into the air. The raft turned a complete flip-flop. When we saw it next, it was speeding landward like a chip before the surf. The three of us were in the water. I can remember spinning head over heels three or four times and raking along the floor of the sea. Whether it was sand or rock, I don't know, but afterward I discovered that a patch of skin about 6 inches in diameter had been scraped from the center of my back. Gene and Tony, I learned, were going through exactly the same thing. Tony said this was the first time he had ever had his eyes open underwater. "Everything was green and pretty," he said. After a threshing by the water that left me only half conscious, I found myself sitting on a flat ledge of coral rock. The raft, I saw, was upside down again and was heading for the beach about 100 yards away from me. Gene and I were close together, and we still had about 300 yards to go to reach solid ground. Tony was about 50 yards behind us. None of us was able to stand. I tried to raise myself on my feet, but couldn't get my balance. Then I found that the current was skidding me along on my bottom. Gene, even with me and to my right, also let himself drift, and we kept abreast. I heard a call for help and looked back. It was Tony. Being unable to swim, he thought he was going to drown. When I waved and yelled, he realized he was out of danger, and thenceforth scooted along like Gene and me. I imagine things had happened so fast that when Tony got into shallow water, he didn't realize it, and possibly he was hollering as a nervous reaction from the terrific beating his shrunken body had taken in the surf. We caught the boat at the very edge of the beach and grabbed the anchor line. Crawling on all fours, we dragged ourselves from the last persistent clutch of the sea and somehow hauled the raft behind us. We tried to stand upon our feet but couldn't. We were terribly dizzy from exhaustion. The whole world seemed to be spinning around us. We lay on the beach together, faintly conscious of the broken coral that was cutting our flaming, sunburned flesh as our bodies jerked in the effort to breathe. When I was able to look about, the sun was low. A short distance away, several rotting piles had been driven into the sand, evidently placed there by someone for tying up boats. The three of us took hold of the anchor line, dragging the raft with one hand, while with the other we pulled ourselves, painfully, inch by inch, over the jagged coral to the row of wooden stakes. I felt each of these ancient poles, selecting the one that was most solid. We tied the boat to that. There were several thatched huts a few yards from where we lay. Grasping one of the pilings with both hands, I pulled myself to my knees. "Boys," I said, "you know there may be Japs here waiting for us." They raised their heads and nodded. I looked at each one closely. They were gazing steadily into my eyes. Tony gestured toward the police whistle, still on a cord about my neck. "If we have to scatter," he suggested calmly, "two blasts on the whistle will be the signal to meet wherever you are." It was agreed. We were too weak to try to find food, so we decided to rest for the night in one of the shacks. I chose 3 long pieces of driftwood lying about that were best suited to my purpose and handed one to each. "If there are Japs on this island," I said, "they'll not see an American sailor crawl. We'll stand and march and make them shoot us down, like men-o'-warsmen." Using the sticks of driftwood as canes to support us, we got on our feet. 3 abreast then, myself in the middle, we walked to the nearest hut and went in.